Chapter 6. The Jewish People and Their Renewal of the Land. The eighth end time prophecy concerning the Jewish people letting us know we're living in the last days is that Israel would blossom as a rose in the desert. But don't take my word for it. Let's listen to God's.
Isaiah 35:1-2. The desert and the parched land will be glad, the wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it will burst into bloom, it will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the splendor of Carmel and Sharon, they will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God.
So here we see God clearly says in the last days that the desert and parched land of Israel will be transformed into a beautiful, splendid environment where the flowers will blossom and flourish even in the wilderness areas. In fact, some translations speak of this supernatural beautification of the land of Israel from God with these words.
The wilderness will rejoice in those days. The desert will blossom with flowers.
Yes, there will be an abundance of flowers and singing and joy. The deserts will become as green as the mountains of Lebanon, as lovely as Mount Carmel's pastures and the plain of Sharon.
Clearly, the deserts of Israel will be transformed into a beautiful garden-like environment in the last days. In fact, Isaiah is not the only one who talks about this amazing transformation. So, does Joel and Ezekiel.
Joel 2:21-24. Be not afraid, O land, be glad and rejoice. Surely the Lord has done great things. Be not afraid, O wild animals, for the open pastures are becoming green. The trees are bearing their fruit, the fig tree and the vine yield their riches. Be glad, O people of Zion, rejoice in the Lord your God, for he has given you the autumn rains in righteousness. He sends you abundant showers, both autumn and spring rains as before. The threshing floors will be filled with grain, the vats will overflow with new wine and oil.
Ezekiel 36:33-36. This is what the Sovereign Lord says: on the day I cleanse you from all your sins, I will resettle your towns, and the ruins will be rebuilt. The desolate land will be cultivated instead of lying desolate in the sight of all who pass through it. They will say, this land that was laid waste has become like the Garden of Eden, the cities that were lying in ruins, desolate and destroyed, are now fortified and inhabited. Then the nations around you that remain will know that I, the Lord, have rebuilt what was destroyed and have replanted what was desolate. I, the Lord, have spoken, and I will do it.
And boy, did he ever. Now, to understand the significance of these prophecies, you have to first understand the history and characteristics of the land of Israel. From the very beginning, that land that was promised to the Israelites was totally different from the land they came from. Think about it. They came out of Egypt and the desert to the what? The promised land. And this promised land was a good land. In fact, it was called a good land 16 times in the Old Testament, and a land flowing with milk and honey 23 times in the Old Testament. There was something special about that land. And even up to the time of Josephus, a first century Jewish historian, he mentioned how the land was still very prosperous and fertile. Here's what he said.
For the whole area is excellent for crops and pasturage and rich in trees of every kind, so that by its fertility it invites even those least inclined to work on the land. In fact, every inch of it has been cultivated by the inhabitants, and not a parcel goes to waste. It is thickly covered with towns, and thanks to the natural abundance of the soil, the many villages are so densely populated.
Now here's the point. All that changed after nearly 2,000 years of foreign conquerors totally abusing the land. They left it a total complete wasteland. And many prophecy teachers believe it was in response to the Jewish people's disobedience toward God's conditional Mosaic covenant, and thus the prophecy and warning of Moses came into play.
Deuteronomy 29:22-28. Your children who follow you in later generations and foreigners who come from distant lands will see the calamities that have fallen on the land and the diseases with which the Lord has afflicted it. The whole land will be a burning waste of salt and sulfur, nothing planted, nothing sprouting, no vegetation growing on it. It will be like the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in fierce anger. All the nations will ask, why has the Lord done this to this land? Why this fierce, burning anger? And the answer will be,
it is because this people abandoned the covenant of the Lord, the God of their fathers, the covenant he made with them when he brought them out of Egypt. They went off and worshipped other gods and bowed down to them, gods they did not know, gods he had not given them. Therefore, the Lord's anger burned against this land, so that he brought on it all the curses written in this book. In furious anger and in great wrath the Lord uprooted them from their land and thrust them into another land, as it is now.
Until the last days when the unconditional covenants kicked in and God had mercy on their disobedience and brought them back into the land again and began to reverse the curse, because he's not done with them. But before that time, the conditions of the land were just like a curse, just like God said. Let's listen to some of the people who visited Israel prior to 1948.
After the scattering of the Jews beginning in 70 AD with the destruction of the temple, the land became utterly desolate, unable to grow much of anything. During nearly 2,000 years of Israel's exile from its land, numerous empires had conquered the land and countless wars were fought for its possession. And yet, amazingly, no conqueror ever succeeded in permanently settling the land and neither were they able to cause it to bloom again. It was in a horrible state. In 1845, Alphen Lamartine, in his book, Recollections from the East, said that, outside the walls of Jerusalem we saw no living being, heard no living voice. We encountered that desolation and that deadly silence which we would have expected to find at the ruined gates of Pompeii. A total eternal dread spell enveloped the city, the highways and the villages. In 1855, an American medical doctor, Jonathan Meese, traveled to the Holy Land and published his recollections in a book titled A Journey to Egypt and Palestine. Israel had been renamed Palestine by the Romans and was still called by that name in the 19th century. Here's what he said: at present, nearly 3,000 years after David, the country is a prey to the wild beasts and to the wilder Bedouins. In 1867, the American journalist Mark Twain made a trip to the area and he published a book about his impressions in 1869 called The Innocents Abroad. This was the book that made Mark Twain famous. In it he described the area as a blistering, naked, treeless land. He said, "The further we went the hotter the sun got and the more rocky, bare, repulsive and dreary the landscape had become." He spoke of the villages as ugly, cramped, squalid, uncomfortable and filthy. He then added that the villages are a solitude to make one dreary, unpeopled desert, rusty mounds of barrenness. And then he looked towards the Judean hills in Israel and wrote, "Close to us was a stream and on its banks a great herd of curious-looking sheep and the sheep were gratefully eating gravel. I do not state this as a petrified fact, I only suppose they were eating gravel because there did not appear to be anything else for them to eat." Then regarding the Sea of Galilee area, he wrote, "There is not a solitary village. There are two or three small clusters of Bedouin tents, but not a single permanent habitation. One may ride 10 miles, hereabouts, and not see 10 human beings." Concerning the Valley of Armageddon, Mark Twain observed, "A desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with the pomp of life and action." He then described the central highlands of Samaria by saying, "There was hardly a tree or a shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. No landscape exists that is more tiresome to the eye than that which bounds the approaches to Jerusalem." His summary of the land was a dismal one. "It truly is monotonous and uninviting. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes, and why should it be otherwise? No man can stand here, in this deserted area, and say that prophecy has not been fulfilled." In 1884, another American tourist, Henry M. Field, published a book about his trip to the area, and in it he wrote about the treeless, desolate landscape as follows: "The country seemed deserted of human habitations. Its appearance was made still more desolate by being without trees. While riding among the hills, I did not see a single tree." Whether this be owing to the government tax on trees, or the wastefulness of the people in cutting for fuel every young tree almost as soon as it shows its head above the ground, I know not, I only state the fact, that the landscape was absolutely treeless. Then in 1905, the Prime Minister of the Netherlands observed, "The Jews have come in vain. Only God can check the blight of the inrushing desert." In 1912, a British traveller by the name of Sir Frederick Treves published a book appropriately titled, "The Land That Is Desolate," and he described the approach to Jerusalem: "The area is practically treeless. Such hedges as exist are mostly of prickly cactus. The villages passed are secretive-looking clumps of flat-topped huts made, it would seem, of a chocolate-coloured mud and decorated with litter and refuse. Surrounding the area of Jerusalem, he observed that the hills are bare save for some hectic grass and starveling scrub.
As for Jerusalem itself, he wrote, the city itself is as the shadow of a rock in a weary land.
With the exception of a few pallid olive trees, a patch here and there of indefinite green, and a melancholy cypress, the environs of Jerusalem are a dusty, ungenial limestone waste. He then described Bethlehem as a drab city of drab houses on a drab ridge, as monotonous in color and as cheerless looking as a pile of dry bones. And even Nazareth, he said, was a sorry country, for the land is bare, harsh, and treeless. Here is assuredly to be seen the poverty of the earth. And regarding Galilee, he described it as abandoned, and Tiberias was a wholly dirty town and a wretched and stinking place with sturdy vermin. In 1924, Israel was still being described as a barren, rocky and forbidding land by Oliver C. Dalby in his booklet, Rambles in Scriptural Lands. He characterized Jerusalem as a place where the streets were narrow and dirty, and where the buildings are austere and unattractive. As Jeremiah prophesied, the land became a haunt of jackals and a heap of ruins.
How many of you would say they were clearly not excelling in the tourism industry at that time? Yeah, clearly you didn't want to go there, it was under a curse. Then on top of that, because of these conditions, rainfall had diminished, and with all the trees cut down, topsoil eroded and excessive sedimentation in the valleys resulted in waterlogging and the creation of swamps. With swamps came an outbreak of malaria which weakened the population and led to the abandonment of villages and formerly cultivated land. The land became repugnant, and during the years the Jews were exiled from it, no one really desired it. It became a deserted wasteland and an incubator of disease. In fact, by the beginning of the 19th century, it was a place people avoided, except for the most fanatical pilgrims, like the Russians who would walk all the way to the Holy Land and die there. But when the Jewish people began to return to the land, everything changed. No foreign conqueror was able to make Israel bloom again, no matter how hard they tried. And frankly, the foreign conquerors had no respect for the land, no concern for it, no love for it, no wonder it wasn't going to respond. But when the Jewish people came back, they loved the land and they began to immediately work at getting the land back into shape. For them, and them alone, the land began to respond. In fact, when the Jews first began to go back in the early 1900s, the Arabs laughed at them for buying the land. Who, but a crazy Jew, would want malaria-infested swampland? And of course, today, guess what? The Arabs want the land back because God touched it, and has made it beautiful once again, just like he promised he would for the Jewish people, like this. Gordon Robertson reports, in 1867 Mark Twain toured the land of Israel. Known back then as Palestine. Here is how he described it.
A desolate country whose soil is rich enough but is given solely to weeds. A silent, mournful expanse. There was hardly a tree or a shrub anywhere. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Desolate and unlovely. Today Mark Twain wouldn't even recognize this land. Out of rocky soil, out of swamps, even out of deserts. The Israelis have created gardens, vineyards, and farms with some of the most innovative techniques in the world. Before Israel even became a state, Jews by the thousands came to live there on communal farms. But when they arrived in the Promised Land, it wasn't exactly flowing with milk and honey. The coastal plains were swampy. The Galilean and the Judean hills were rocky, and the southern half of the country was mostly desert.
Itzik Moshe, Southern Director, Jewish National Fund, since the people of Israel left our homeland over 2,000 years ago, the area was mismanaged. So, we want to reserve and rehabilitate this holy land. Gordon Robertson, the early Jewish settlers faced a number of obstacles, from bad soil to Bedouin raiders, but they faced an even bigger enemy that threatened to destroy the Jewish state before it even began.
In the early decades of the 20th century, Israel was a breeding ground for mosquitoes carrying malaria. They overtook the coastal plains of the Jordan Valley, the only land available for Jews to buy since the local Arabs decided that it was inhabitable. In 1920, more than a third of the Jewish residents in Palestine had malaria. So, with no other choice, they went to work. They drained the swamp and sprayed the land and changed the flow of water in irrigation canals to interrupt the mosquitoes' breeding. They were so successful that the commission from the League of Nations visited Palestine to learn what they did. Less than 20 years after Israel's official statehood, Israel was malaria-free. Once the threat of malaria was gone, Jewish settlers were focused on making the desert bloom. In the coastal plains, citrus grows to replace the swamps, and the Jordan Valley, once the center of the malaria epidemic, now became the country's breadbasket. The Negev Desert blossomed with the newly planted forest and vineyards, and the once most arid part of Israel became a flourishing vegetable industry.
In other words, the desert is blooming again, just like God said it would, in the last days, right before our very eyes. And as you saw, when the early Jewish settlers came back to the land, they didn't mess around. They really appreciated getting the land back again, so they immediately began to put into play several different plans, deliberate plans, to get the land to renew again. The first plan they implemented to help renew the land was to replant the trees. Now again, as we saw, by the beginning of the 20th century the Jewish homeland was in complete disarray and desolation. Nearly all the trees had been cut down. In fact, one author in the 1800s counted the trees there and reported that there were less than 1,000. From the Sea of Galilee to the south, all the trees had been cut down. They were gone. Now, this deforestation started back in 70 AD when the Romans laid siege to Jerusalem and destroyed their temple. The Roman army single-handedly altered the landscape of the area at that time. They cut down the forest to build stockade towers and battering rams to breach the city's walls, and then Emperor Titus ordered that every tree within 10 miles of Jerusalem be cut down. In fact, the Jewish historian Josephus wrote about the effects of this deforestation after the battle.
"And truly, the very view itself was a melancholy thing, for those places which were adorned with trees and pleasant gardens, were now a desolate country every way, and its trees were all cut down. Nor could any foreigner that had formerly seen Judea and the most beautiful suburbs of the city, and now saw it as a desert, do anything but lament and mourn ever so sadly at so great a change."
Then, on top of that, throughout the centuries, what trees were left, some had been cut down for firewood, others for other military uses from other conquerors, and still others burned whole forests just for hunting purposes. What last remnants of forests were left in Israel were cut down in modern times to fire up the Turkish railway engines. In fact, during this time the Turkish government even put a tax on trees, so there was now an incentive to cut down what trees were left, otherwise you'd have to pay a heavy tax on them. So, by the time the Jewish pioneers got there, there was virtually no trees left, just like the reports state. But when God says the desert will blossom again into garden-like conditions, it doesn't matter how bad it is, it's going to happen no matter what. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. The Jewish people literally began to systematically replant, by hand, the destroyed forests, one by one, all by themselves, and simultaneously cleared the land of rocks so it could be recultivated. They even founded an organization called JNF, or the Jewish National Fund, that raised money from the Jewish population from around the world at that time to help repurchase the land and to restore it. Just that one organization alone was responsible for planting over 250 million trees, building 180 dams and reservoirs, and establishing more than 1,000 parks. In fact, they even followed the Bible's lead that told them what kind of trees to plant and where to plant them, so they would flourish in that kind of arid environment. And sure enough, the trees began to take off. And as a result, Israel was the only nation in the world to enter the 21st century with more trees than what they started off with, and one report shared how right now, due to this massive tree replanting campaign, there are over 1.2 billion trees in Israel. And believe it or not, this massive reintroduction of trees to the area has actually had an effect on the rainfall of the area. It is estimated that Israel's rainfall has increased now by over 450%. As one researcher stated, "God has kept his promise, it's a land of milk and honey once again, and it's a sign that Jesus is coming soon." Gordon Robertson, "Today the world is focused upon saving the environment. But Israelis were green long before it was popular, about a century before. It's Ik Moshe, it's part of the Israeli dream to create a green land, a green country, and in time with experience and research, we studied how to do it." Gordon Robertson, "The prophet Isaiah wrote about a time when the desert would rejoice and blossom as a rose. To the Israelis, that is more than an ancient prophecy. It's a commandment." Nady Barak, "Netifim drip irrigation, Israel is a tiny state. Look at a map of our region. We used to always joke, there isn't enough space on the map to write the name Israel. We have to conserve it, to keep it, to maintain it. This is what we have." Gordon Robertson, "To the early settlers in Israel, the word green meant planting trees, and they started in the Negev Desert. A place that gets only 1 to 7 inches of rain per year. In the 1940s, Jerusalem was still under Arab control, and Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, believed that the Negev was the future of Israel. So, he ordered the creation of a man-made forest there. His esteemed scientists said it couldn't be done. Ben-Gurion's response was, "No problem, we'll get new scientists."
The Prime Minister got his new scientists and the Negev Desert began to blossom. Today the Atir Forest has more than 4 million trees, including carob, pine, olive and figger.
Yitzhak Moshe, Israel is among the few countries in the world that at the end of the 20th century has much more trees than at the beginning of the century. Now we have planted more than 240 million trees, which is a nice number to this small country. Gordon Robertson, in the center of the forest is a vineyard planted on the ruins of another one that existed here 2,000 years ago. Scientists researched the best plants to grow in the Negev and one of their sources was the Bible. Yitzhak Moshe, there are plenty of archaeological ruins everywhere, water cisterns, dams, and terraces everywhere, and we have started construction on some of these ancient farms where we have planted biblical trees, and the trees are surviving without additional irrigation by connecting the same cisterns as our forefathers did 2,000 years ago. The fact that we are so flourishing here is a sign that this is God's will. This is what is supposed to happen. This is the plan. You know, that in the last days, God would not only call the Jewish people back into the land, but he'd use the very same people to renew the land and have it blossom as a rose in the desert. Where have I heard that before? Even the secular Jewish people see the prophetic significance of this event. How about us? Or are we still concerned about what time that game starts? But that's not all. The second plan the Jewish people implemented to help renew the land in the last days was to redirect the water. Again, as we saw, when the Jews returned to the land, they did not find it as a land flowing with milk and honey. Instead, they were faced with trying to eke out a living in a desert wasteland plagued with malaria-infested swamps. They paid exorbitant prices for the land and the Muslims who lived there laughed all the way to the bank. They thought they were crazy. But not for long. The early Jewish settlers immediately began draining the swamps to get rid of the malaria-infested mosquitoes. Then they imported eucalyptus trees from Australia to plant around the perimeters of the swamps because those types of trees absorb huge amounts of water. On top of that, just to make sure, they even dug canals to drain the swamps out into the sea. That was just to get rid of the bad water. Then they went about creating good water for the land, and here they literally became pioneers in water conservation and water distribution techniques. They figured out a way to get water from the Sea of Galilee in the north, to the major cities in the south, and even further south into the Negev Desert. In 1953 they devised a system of complex giant pipes, open canals, tunnels, reservoirs and massive pumping stations to get the job done, and it worked incredibly well. They even took some of the water from the Sea of Galilee and channeled it into various sections of the deserts, which have allowed the deserts to literally begin to blossom with an abundance of flowers. Even to the point where Israel is now a major exporter of flowers and ornamental plants all around the world, just like the Bible said would happen in the last days. Then they became masters of conserving what water they did have by developing drip irrigation systems that specifically distributed the precious water at the base of each plant, wasting not a drop. On top of that, to keep up with the growing water needs of the population, the Jewish people became experts in desalination plants, turning salt water into fresh water. They literally line their ocean coastlines with desalination plants all along the Mediterranean coast of Israel, and they are now providing almost 40% of the nation's water needs. When it comes to water conservation and water technology, they are way ahead of the rest of the world. In fact, as of 2016, Israel was producing 20% more water than it consumed. They went from having no water, to diseased water, to more than what they need. Can you believe that? And now they even provide water to their neighbors and export their water technology to the rest of the world. In fact, they recently hosted the Israel-California Water Conference in Marina del Rey, California, with the goal of bringing long-term help to drought-ravaged California. They're even helping us. Meanwhile, Israel keeps becoming greener and more fruitful every year because of their mastery of the water supply. Gordon Robertson, thousands of years ago Moses had to strike a rock to get water in the desert, but today the Israelis are taking a slightly different approach using technology and creativity. In Israel, main sources of drinking water are the Sea of Galilee and two underground aqueducts. If rainfall is short, so is the nation's water supply. In 1953 Israel started building the National Water Carrier. A system of pipelines, canals, and reservoirs carrying water from the Sea of Galilee to the rest of Israel. Jonathan Medved, Israeli venture capitalist, "So, we didn't have water, okay, we developed technology. One of the things that Israel has excelled in is what some people would see as risk factor as far as taking curses and turning them into blessings." Gordon Robertson, "For thousands of years the Mediterranean Sea was the center of the ancient world, the crossroads between Europe, Asia, and Africa. Now it's one of Israel's greatest natural resource. Jonathan Medved, Israel has desalinated so much of its drinking water, the majority of our drinking water's origin, will be the Mediterranean Sea by the end of next year. Gordon Robertson, today Israel produces 450 million cubic meters of drinkable water a day, a water surplus. Jonathan Medved, in this country we don't have much water, except somehow by the end of this decade, Israel is going to become a net water exporter. Just on today's news there was an item about how Israel is stepping up the export of water to Jordan in order to supply water to all the Syrian refugees who are fleeing into Jordan. Today Israel recycles 80% of its wastewater. The closest competitor is Spain with 10%. So, we recycle more than 8 times more water than any other country on the planet. Gordon Robertson, Israelis developed a way to purify wastewater using ultraviolet light. This treated water is then used to irrigate crops. Nadi Barak, if you use it for vegetables, then you like to clean it, so you can almost drink it, it is treated to a very high degree. Today 60% of the water that is irrigating fields in Israel is produced water, not natural water. Gordon Robertson, today, even the driest parts of the desert are blooming with help from a process called drip irrigation. Nadi Barak, sometimes with 20 millimeters of rain annual fall, very harsh climate, and still thanks to drip irrigation this has become the vegetable bowl of Israel. 65% of vegetable exports out of Israel are going to Europe. 6. In other words, the desert, which is blossoming with a bunch of flowers and fruits and vegetables and all kinds of things, is exactly what the prophet Isaiah foresaw more than 2,800 years ago. But that's not all. The third plan the Jewish people implemented to help renew the land in the last days was to revitalize the agriculture. As you just saw, there's a big payoff for Israel's hard work and innovation in renewing the land with trees and water resources. They've now become one of the biggest producers of agriculture on the planet. As one person stated, when people think of Jews, they normally think of people who have excelled in the area of finance. But modern Jews in Israel have made their mark in agricultural production and high-tech innovations. This is because when the Jewish people first came back to the land, they organized themselves into these fortress-like communities called a kibbutz. These were collective farms that provided mutual help for each other as well as shared protection from Arab attacks. As a result of these tight-knit communities and the sharing of their information with each other, the results are phenomenal. The land that was totally desolate at the beginning of the 20th century is now the breadbasket of the Middle East. Israel is not only more than self-sufficient, but it exports agricultural products to both the Arab countries of the Middle East and to the various nations of Europe, and they produce a massive range of crops. We just think it's all desert there, but right now they produce wheat, sorghum, corn, all kinds of vegetables, tomatoes, cucumbers, pepper, zucchinis, citrus fruits, avocados, kiwis, guavas, mangoes, grapes, melons, bananas, dates, apples, pears, cherries, oranges, grapefruit, tangerines, you name it, they can grow it. Including, as we saw, flowers. They grow vast quantities of flowers for export. Israel exports 1.5 billion flowers and vegetables to Europe and the US, most of which are grown in the desert, exactly like Isaiah said. And what they do grow is some of the biggest and tastiest produce in the world. This is because the water they pump from underneath the desert is brackish, or in other words, salty. Normally you would think this would be the worst kind of water for plants to grow in. However, it just so happens that this saltiness in Israel's water underground actually improves the fruit. What happens when you irrigate the fruits or the vegetables with brackish water is that the plant goes into stress, and so it produces less leaves and more fruit with less water inside, which makes it have more meat, and this helps to make it 3 times sweeter than usual produce. It's almost like when God said this land was a good land and a land flowing with milk and honey, that it just needed the right people to get back there and make it come alive again, by pumping out that brackish water. Gee, I wonder who that is? The Jewish people maybe? But as you can see, flat out, Israel, the once barren desert wasteland filled with mosquitoes and malaria where pilgrims went and died, is now, in our lifetime, the world's leader in agricultural research and development. To the point where the American Society for Horticultural Sciences recently stated that Israel's desert agricultural technology is one of the most significant advances in food production in the past 1,000 years. Even the United Nations, which normally specializes in condemning Israel, has declared that Israel is the most agriculturally efficient land on planet Earth. Now, as if that wasn't enough proof that Israel is blossoming as a rose in the desert, and it's becoming again a land flowing with milk and honey, I've got one more for you. Israeli cows are the best milk producers in the world, and their dairies produce the highest amounts of milk per animal in the world. They're being called super cows. Julie Stahl, Israel, in the Bible God promised the Jewish people a land flowing in milk and honey. And while it is a sign of abundance, it's also literal. Moshe Kempinski, author, the term milk and honey is critical. It's used 20 times in scripture. Julie Stahl, but when the Jewish people returned from 2,000 years in exile, they found a barren, desert land. An Orthodox Jewish author, Moshe Kempinski, said that was all in God's plan. Moshe Kempinski, God says I need something miraculous, I'm going to create a land, that even though it has those kinds of issues, it will be a land filled with dates and milk and honey. So that they know nothing comes here except when it is from me. Julie Stahl, and God has delivered on that promise. Despite the heat, humidity, and limited resources, the Israeli cow produces more milk per year than cows in the US, European Union, and Australia. And what about the honey? Most believe honey during Bible time probably came from date trees. There are tens of thousands of acres of date trees in Israel. Some 3,000 of those trees are planted here. Each one of the trees at Kibbutz Katori produces about 350 pounds of dates each year. They even managed to sprout a 2,000-year-old date seed found by archaeologists years ago at Masada. Nicknamed Methuselah, the tree is now 5 years old. Today Israel's dates are still famous throughout the world. Israel exports some 12,000 tons of dates each year to 20 countries. According to Kempinski, the revival of trees in the land is the first sign of redemption. Moshe Kempinski, Ezekiel 36 says, shoot forth your branches, give forth your fruit, for your children are coming home. That's an unusual thing for God to tell a tree. That's what he created the tree to do. God is saying in Leviticus, it's going to be a desolate land when I take you out, but when I bring my people back home, this land is going to come forth with blossoms and trees and fruits. Julie Stahl, so he says, every day you eat and the milk you drink here is like prophecy being fulfilled. 7. In other words, right before your very eyes. Why? Because in the last days God said the land would blossom as a rose in the desert and return to be a land flowing with milk and honey. Even that specific detail is coming to pass. As one guy stated, can there be any doubt that this amazing prophecy of the renewing of the land of Israel in the end times has been fulfilled? Answer, no. It's happening right before our very eyes in our lifetime, which means we're living in the last days. Yet, what's our attitude? So what? Who cares? Hey, the game is starting, chop chop. It's like we're staring at this picture and it doesn't even faze us. All these prophetic events concerning the renewal of the land of Israel are unfolding before our very eyes, and it is just like a speeding train whistle, letting us know the 7-year tribulation is near and the rapture is even closer. The smoke pouring out of the stack is all these signs, and what's our attitude? Who cares? The game's about to begin, finish up already, will you? If that's you, you need to ask yourself, why are you treating a church service like it's a boring religious service that you come to once a week, so you can punch in your religious time clock and then hurry up and get back in the world? Could it be it's because you're one of these people Jesus warned about?
Matthew 7:21-23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.
Basically, Jesus is saying, religious people don't go to heaven. Religious people go to hell. Oh, you went to church services all right, but you couldn't wait to get out and get back to the world. It was all for the appearances of men, because your heart never belonged to Christ. You were just into a Christian religion and you went straight to hell. I didn't say that, Jesus did. And is that a chance you really want to take? This is why, out of love, God has given us this update on the final countdown, tribulation rising concerning the Jewish people and the Antichrist, to show us that the 7-year tribulation is near, and the return of Jesus Christ is rapidly approaching. And that's why Jesus himself said.
Luke 21:28, when these things begin to take place, stand up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near.
Like it or not, we are headed for the final countdown. The signs of the 7-year tribulation are rising all around us. It's time to wake up. So, the point is this. If you're reading this today and you're not a Christian, then I beg you, please heed these signs, heed these warnings, give your life to Jesus now. You don't want to be here when God pours out his judgment upon the nations. It's the worst time in the history of mankind, so horrible that unless God shortened the time frame, the entire human race would be destroyed. The only way to escape is through Jesus. Take the way out now before it's too late. Get saved today. Listen to the whistle blowing. But, if you're reading this today and you're a Christian, then it's high time we stop goofing off and getting distracted with this world. Let's get busy working together sharing the gospel with as many as we can. Let's leave here being true relational Christians longing for His return and excited about the news of His soon return. Amen?